Independent journalist Sandra Cuff continues explaining what she saw at Tangkonten Airport on Sunday when ousted President Zelaya's plane was set to land in Honduras.
So it was a very celebratory and nonviolent atmosphere. About a third, maybe, of the main concentration of people gathered outside the main entrance walked further up the boulevard, which curves around the airport, so about 5 to 10 minute walk around the backside of Tangkonten Airport, because there's really great view of the whole, all of the runways and landing strips at the airport. And at that point, the runways and airstrips were heavily militarized by the Honduran army. There were no police present there, whereas in most situations, there are police lines between the soldiers and the people. At that point, on the runways, it was just the Honduran army. And there were, what's the English word, sharpshooters, riflemen, up in the air control towers and the top of the buildings all over the place. Those are Honduran armed forces, the army. So I wasn't directly up behind the runway. There's a big fence separating the people from, you know, the runways, maybe half a kilometer, I don't know, at least a couple hundred meters. I was at the airport entrance, as was the majority of the concentration of people, when we heard shots fired. First were sort of individual shots, which were whatever that word is for a sharpshooter. And then there were actually M16 machine gun fire, rapid fire. And so the word got around to the main concentration of people quickly that there are people who are being shot and wounded. So myself and many other journalists and many other people made our way quickly up there to see what had been going on. And things had been sort of heating up between that part of the march and the soldiers, who had no police lines between them and the people. And tear gas canisters were fired. Some people started taking down, just a very symbolic action with absolutely no threat or intention of storming anything behind it, but taking down parts of the fence. Once again, it's quite a distance to the runway and the soldiers up on a hill where people were on the other side of the fence, and nobody crossed that fence. And many soldiers, not all, but many soldiers, first there were the first shot, which were targeted by a sharpshooter somewhere, probably up in one of the towers, and then other soldiers on the runway and landing strip opened fire with M16s against the entirely 100% unarmed civilian population that was demonstrating at least a couple hundred meters away on the other side of the fence. So myself and others got there soon after that had happened. And there's still, I've been based out of the office of a human rights organization, the Committee of Relatives of the Detained Disappeared in Honduras. There's a couple other independent journalists from Honduras. I've been based in and out of here. And between the team of journalists and human rights activists, there's still a lot of information that has not been able to be confirmed. But for sure, on Sunday, July 5th, out behind the Tangkonten Airport, Isi Soled Murillo Mencia, who was 19 years old, was shot in the head and killed immediately. He was from Santa Cruz de Guayape, which is in the department of Olancho in northeastern Honduras, and he was actually living in Comayagüela, which is Tegucigalpa's twin city, selling fruit in the markets for a living. So he was shot and killed, and he was registered, taken to the hospital and then the morgue, and his body was registered in both the hospital and the morgue. There were several other people shot and wounded, up to 30 wounded by a lot of reports, and there are multiple witnesses who claim to have seen three other people die. One was an 8-year-old child, Darlin, and then there was a woman and a man of, nobody knows thus far their name, age, or where they're from. And one of the reasons that it's being so hard to confirm this information is because they, although they were taken in ambulances to Hospital Escuela, which is one of the main hospitals in Tegucigalpa, and there's multiple witnesses who have come forward with their name, photo, who themselves suffered gunshot wounds, who were taken to that same hospital and saw other wounded people. In one case, a woman who was also wounded by Hunter Namsos' gunfire saw her die in the hospital. None of those other people were registered either in the hospital or the morgue. And so that lack of official documentation and the absolute, you know, difficulty of just the time it takes to figure out who these people were, where they were from, to be able to, you know, find out from their families or whoever they were with the full information. So at this point, multiple witnesses, you know, confirm at least 4 deaths and multiple more wounded by 109 forces gunfire on July 5th. But so far, the only one who's been absolutely confirmed with documentation is Isu Soler Morillo Mencias from Olancho.
So let's talk about some measures that have been taken against the civilian population. We know that a curfew has been imposed. We know that civilians no longer have access to media surrounding the coup. Do you see the situation calming down this week, or do you think that there will be an escalation in the coming days?
It's hard to say right now what's going to be happening over the next few days. There was definitely, just massive repression across the board. The previous Sunday, the 28th, when the coup actually happened, there were at least 7 media outlets that suffered military intervention. In some cases, that included illegal detentions by armed forces, beatings. Another journalist who works with several radio and TV stations up on the North Coast has been murdered by unidentified person in civilian dress. He was shot several times as he was leaving the radio station and heading home on his motorcycle. You know, there's been hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of detentions because of the military curfew, which, you know, I don't even want to use the word legally because it was illegal and was never actually published and was never a decree, but according to Honduran law, a suspension of constitutional rights, which is what the military curfew is, can be detained without any charges because your right to free circulation has been absolutely suspended. The first week that was officially from 9 p.m. until 6 a.m. However, the last few days of the first week, because of these huge mobilizations at the airport, during mid-afternoon, over, you know, the mainstream Honduran media, which is sort of has helped orchestrate the coup and is blocking a lot of information. Through that media, the coup government announced that all of a sudden, like 3 hours ahead of time, the military imposed curfew was going to be 6 p.m. one night, and then July 5th, it was 6:30. And at this point, you know, when people find out about it, it's already around 5 p.m., and everyone's still at the airport. So, you know, the military curfew is totally illegal. It was just extended actually now to 10 p.m. to 4:30 a.m. These are totally illegal decrees, and it's being used in many cases to demobilize people who are actively participating in the resistance movement. And one good example of that was on July 5th when, you know, by the time people actually found out about the change to the military curfew time, that was changed to 6:30 p.m., that doesn't even give a large portion of the people who are at the mobilization time enough to walk back to wherever they need to get to within the capital. There's still lots of detentions going on because of that. There's still a lot of repression going on, especially in other parts of the country. A lot of the international media and generally media coverage is focused here and in the second largest city of Honduras, which is San Pedro Sula, up north. Elsewhere, like in Olancho, there are many reports, but not unconfirmed, of Honduran armed forces forcibly recruiting youth. There's a lot of youth who have fled into the mountains, literally, to avoid this. A lot of people who are making their way to these mobilizations from Olancho again and other sort of northeastern Honduras. There is even CNN footage of Honduran armed forces shooting out the tires of the buses so that people would not make it on time to the mobilizations and would be stuck. Right now, things are a little bit calmer. That mostly has to do with yesterday, the president of Costa Rica, Oscar Arias, who negotiated the peace accords in Central America in the 1990s, he once again offered to mediate, this time just in Honduras, between both sides, so between elected and legitimate President Manuel Zelaya and the coup government, which is both military and political, from both parties, actually, both main parties. So that's starting tomorrow, Thursday, in San Jose. And so because of that, things have calmed down over the past couple of days.
You talked about how, in light of the recent events, local media have been supportive of the coup government. But let's talk about international media. Do you see any kind of incongruencies between what's being reported in the international media and what's actually happening on the ground?
Yeah. You know, it's so almost sort of a, in some ways, the opposite of what has happened in terms of media coverage in the past decades ago, when there's been military coups and military intervention. An example is Panama in 1989, which most people don't even know was invaded by the United States because there was actually a media blackout and the U.S. military detained all international journalists for 72 hours. So in this case, you know, it's mostly the mainstream Honduran media that are participating in this media blackout, because mostly they're owned by the same elite that are part of both the two main parties in Congress, which orchestrated together with the military too. So in terms of international media, there's actually a lot more coverage and more accurate, to some degree, coverage. I mean, literally in the marches, there's people holding signs that are thanking CNN for its coverage. Not CNN, the U.S. version, but CNN, the international Spanish version. And so, to some degree, international media coverage has been positive because people in Honduras, you know, there's TV channels that have been totally blocked. Telesur from Venezuela is one of the places that's doing amazing international coverage, so is Al Jazeera English. The Telesur channel within Honduras has been blocked, along with several others. But people, especially in the capital, you know, get access to internet to be able to see the international coverage of what's going on within their own country. In terms of incongruencies, while in general it has been positive that there is international coverage, a lot of people have noticed, especially in the U.S. and Canadian media, we've been noticing certain sort of myths put forward by the coup government that have been taken up and not really questioned or analyzed by international media. And it also sort of follows along with the United States and Canadian government's role in Honduras and especially within the OAS about the coup in Honduras. So one of the things that's misrepresented is that basically Manuel Zelaya is being painted by everybody as being, you know, the next Chavez, he's a communist, et cetera, et cetera. And the non-binding consultation that was take place, and I think it actually did take place, on Saturday the 28th, which was what sort of triggered the coup, that's being painted as basically the exact same thing as the actual binding referendum in Venezuela. And while there are similarities, what international media have been focusing on is the fact that one part of the Manuel Zelaya's proposed constitutional reforms would allow for re-election. not in this election, in the next one, 2013. Basically, you know, the coup government, our military and political and economic elite of Honduras have been saying, you know, Manuel Zelaya is going to be the next communist dictator, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And not quite with that same kind of Cold War rhetoric, international media definitely haven't been delving into what the non-binding consultation was actually about. It was about whether or not the people of Honduras want a fourth ballot box at the general elections in November, which would be a binding referendum on constitutional reform. And so one small element would allow for re-election, not back-to-back terms in this case. It would be like Manuel Zelaya himself, if he were to want to be re-elected, it wouldn't be until 2013 elections. But that's such a, that's all really that most people, both pro-coup and supposedly critical international media, have been really focusing on. But the actual constitutional reforms, the proposal that would be on, you know, the binding referendum that, you know, may take place at for the fourth ballot box at the upcoming election in November, is a whole range of proposals ranging from a hike in minimum wage in the country. One thing that's probably a definite trigger for the current coup situation is the nationalization of several services and resources that have been privatized over the years. You know, there's elements about free education, free healthcare. So it's a really progressive proposal. And none of that is really being discussed in the media. And also the fact that, you know, on Sunday, June 28th, it wasn't the actual referendum. It was a non-binding consultation to see if people actually want this referendum as, you know, binding referendum in November for the general election. So that's one definite point that maybe it's more sort of, you know, an omission than an actual, you know, lie or just outright manipulation, but it's a really important omission. And, you know, the whole quote-unquote legality of the non-binding consultation of the referendum and of the coup itself, you know, for a while the United States government position was, well, not really sure whether this is a military coup or not. The Canadian counselor to the Organization of American States sort of, to some degree, has the same sort of rhetoric, which, because the Supreme Court of Honduras unanimously declared that the non-binding consultation was unconstitutional, which was an entirely political decision. It's a political Supreme Court. It's actually a political nomination process in Honduras by both main political parties. They're nominated from Congress. So that's sort of being used as an excuse to say, well, is it a coup or isn't it a coup or what is it really and what's the legality? And sort of try to paint it as this, you know, sort of gray area situation. You know, also commenting on the fact that, you know, according to polls, Manuel Zelaya had very little support in the country. You know, there's detractors within his own political party, which is true. You know, the majority of the Liberal Party orchestrated the coup against their own, you know, president. All of that is just creating, you know, trying to create this idea that maybe it's not really a military coup. Maybe it's actually better. And, I mean, that's just totally ridiculous. It really is, in many ways, a black and white situation. There's no question as to whether it is a coup or not and as to whether it is a military coup or not. It's definitely different from the military coups that, you know, happen so frequently in pretty much the entire past century in Latin America, in that in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and before that, it was the armed forces, and in many cases the U.S. armed forces as well, that were, you know, publicly, you know, military forces, soldiers on the streets, that's who was actually controlling the presidency. And so this, you know, one of the reasons that there's so much overwhelming concern and support, especially, you know, throughout Latin America, is that people are sort of looking at what's going on in Honduras as though this is sort of, it's a new kind of coup, like a 21st century coup, and this is what's going on now in Honduras is sort of like a test to see whether, you know, this new kind of coup will work, whether people can actually get away with it, whether they can get away with saying that it's not a military coup.
Talk about the precedence of this coup in Honduran history.
I mean, the history of Honduras, you know, in the 1980s, the U.S. Armed Forces actually called Honduras, the country of Honduras, they called it USS Honduras, as though it were a United States Army battleship. So in terms of U.S. intervention and occupation and military intervention and the role of the United States, you know, you really are looking at the whole entire history of Honduras since the United States was the United States. In terms of, you know, the banana companies up north, mining in the interior and in the capital, and, you know, I would have to talk for hours to talk about, you know, how far back this goes, because this is, the history of Honduras is the history of North American invasion, occupation, and domination and repression. It's something that has continued until today. There's still a U.S., actually there's more than one, but there's one really big, quote-unquote, joint, but basically United States Air Force base in Honduras. In the 1970s and 80s, Honduras was USS Honduras. It was the base of operations for mostly covert United States military and CIA operations, counterinsurgency operations in all of Central America. So, you know, against the Sandinistas in neighboring Nicaragua, against the Guatemalan and El Salvadoran guerrilla movements in neighboring Guatemala and El Salvador. You know, one of the main military coup leaders is Billy Joya. And he was part of, he was actually a really crucial figure in the 1970s and 80s in the sort of clandestine Battalion 3-16 in Honduras, which was trained by the CIA as well as CIA-trained Chilean and Argentinian advisors from, you know, the dirty war in Argentina and the Pinochet coup in Chile. So Billy Joya, you know, he's actually very sort of almost publicly known as being linked to, he was essentially like the head of the surveillance, illegal detention, torture, and assassination of a lot of social movement activists, human rights activists, students, lawyers in the 1970s and especially the 80s. And he, for the past while, has been sort of an advisor to Micheletti as president of Congress, and now he's one of the most prominent military figures who orchestrated this coup and is in power. And, you know, none of this, like I said, like, not just on that side, none of this history has gone away. There are actually people within Manuel Zelaya's liberal government, including Milton Jimenez, who was actually, in 1982, was a student and was illegally detained for a long period of time, blindfolded, almost starved, tortured by Battalion 316 along with five other students, some of whom are now prominent political figures. And the person who was identified by the students and by witnesses as having detained them was Billy Joya.